We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
I'm in a Halloween-y mood. How about you?
Spooktacular, buddy.
All right. We want to cover a lot of ground here today, and well, let's start with a classic when it comes to ghosts and witches, Shakespeare's Scottish play.
That would be Macbeth.
No, you said it! Oh, no!
Am I cursed?
Nah, it's on the phone. We think we're covered if it's on the phone.
Wait, what's this thing you're doing? I'm not familiar with this.
Well, you know, if you say it in a theater, then you could be in big trouble.
Well, Kimball, it's like a bucket filled with water. That's my life. You can't get any more cursed in it. So I can take on a little extra and have some spillage. So Macbeth. There you go.
You've done it for all of us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I kind of set myself up there. Speaking of which, our man Macbeth is set up, isn't he? And that's always sort of interested me about this play, that everyone talks about Macbeth's ambition, but it's really lined up for things to go poorly for him. And he's just out there walking around with his buddy Banquo and comes upon these three weird sisters, and they beckon him over and they set him up for a fall. And I think what's really cool about this play, and it was the play that really got me into Shakespeare, is that it's such a potboiler. It's filled with, of course, blood and fury, and who knew the old man had so much blood in him, which is an incredibly gory line when you think about it, and ghosts, and because we think of ghosts as, like, I don't know, a more recent phenomenon, that you didn't have ghosts back in the 1600s or whatnot, and certainly they did, and this was a real just a potboiler of a play. You have Macbeth going mad, you have the three sisters, the witches, of course, and Banquo's ghost is pretty terrifying, and I think it's really kind of a great gateway Shakespeare play for kids. I remember reading a bunch of years ago, I think it was 7 years ago today he died, so it was in my mind, Lou Reed, and Lou Reed had said that he regretted that he had gone that far in life and he hadn't read everything by Shakespeare. So that's always something that stuck with me, too. If you only go around once, you want to make sure that you get all of the Shakespeare in, or as much as you can. And Macbeth is a good one that hooks you on going further.
And it really, in many ways, establishes that feel for what a good ghost story ought to be. It's very atmospheric.
Sure, certainly. And that's what Orson Welles tapped into, right? With his, albeit highly stylized, adaptation of Macbeth that he made on the cheap in just a couple of weeks and brought it in under budget. But it's a primeval play of the hinterlands, and you're out there in the woods and in the mere and the fields and the boggy fens and marshes, all of that going on. And it's not like you have the sense that the sun doesn't really come out in Macbeth at all, but it's rain and it's heat and it's boggy, and it's what you'd expect Halloween to be like in your mind's eye, in your imagination. And the idea that you have all these ghosts showing up, and we'll get into this later, but I think Macbeth, he manifests some of the ghosts, but for him, they're quite real, and I don't think you could disabuse somebody of the legitimacy of ghosts if they themselves believe that they're real based upon their experiences. And we, the readers or the playgoers who are careful not to say Macbeth in theater, are living that waking nightmare with him where everything is off. And that's the whole idea of unnatural order. And Shakespeare is quite clever with it, the way all of these predictions end up coming true. Because when the predictions are made, you, and of course Macbeth, draw certain conclusions in your mind, and the witches are going to hoodwink all of us. The whole idea of the forest is going to march on the castle. And you think, well, I'm certainly safe from that. That's not going to happen. That's not a thing. But then in a very clever, sophisticated way, yes, indeed, that is what happens.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to a favorite series of both of us, Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone, and we wanted to talk about some of the scariest episodes. And I do you think of Twilight Zone as a scary series?
I do, fractionally. I think of it as an omnibus series that had, I wouldn't say a huge amount of range, because each episode really falls into like one of six or seven categories. Sometimes they were comedic, sometimes they were nostalgic, sometimes they were straight up aliens, sometimes they were period pieces, and sometimes they're set in the here and now. And I think The Twilight Zone did that really well, and they were horror episodes. I think that comedy and The Twilight Zone, it doesn't really mix. And period pieces, with a few exceptions, that wasn't what Rod Serling did well either. Unless it was a Western, he was good at those. Mm. But the horror episodes do stand out to me, and they were the ones that drew me into The Twilight Zone as a whole. And I think that they're overshadowed by dint of what other episodes were. And some of the most efficacious episodes weren't really horror episodes. We've talked about The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, which is horror, but it's sociological horror. It's not like really this fantastical horror that we associate with this particular season, with what we just talked about in Macbeth. But yeah, there are some that I think are absolute doozies of television horror. And I'm sure, like, what one stand out for you horror-wise?
In my top three, it has to be Living Doll.
I see that on a lot of lists. Now, I never really found that one that scary, because, I don't know, I feel like it was a trope, the whole idea of this object being animated. Like, in theory, the Hitchhiker episode should be scarier to me, maybe, but I'm just so familiar with that
right.
particular trope. It began as an E.F. Benson story, and then it was going to be a play, a radio play later, and written for Orson Welles to act in, and he did it a bunch of times, and now it's coming around, and it's like third or fourth, fifth, whatever it is, iteration on The Twilight Zone. I find the scariest one for me, just leaving out my own personal sort of fears that I have going in, is When the Sky Was Opened.
Oh, yes.
When you have the three astronauts come back. And I think it's so frightening because we all fear effacement, that we're going to be scrubbed from our own lives and scrubbed from the memories of the people that we either, who either love us or we want to love us, and it will be as though we never existed. And what's so terrifying about that episode too is that it's set in these very Quixotian recognizable places, the hospital, the bar, and not in like a grim way in the hospital. It's like, we're back, we're getting checked up, time to celebrate, this went really well. And people just start getting effaced, these three buddies. It becomes like that cone, the way their names, this creepy cone, the way their names are repeated, and Harrington just becomes sort of this verbal riff throughout. So that's a frightening one to me. Another one would be The Grave. I said that they don't really do period pieces well, but Westerns tend to work on The Twilight Zone. And you have Lee Marvin shooting his mouth off in a saloon, and it's just such a dismal night. It's just such a Halloween type of night for this episode. And he had this rival, and the rival's dead, and they make this bet that you wouldn't go out to his grave and, like, stick this knife in the ground. And he's like, no, I'll do that. And you think, like, again, it's very Macbethian. You think, like, how badly can this go, right? Your blood pressure might go up a little bit while you're out there. But he ends up losing his life, and again, in a clever way. And for me personally, because I have a fear of planes that is just not rational, I used to take the train to visit my family in Chicago, and that was not a good time, being on the train for 20 hours, is a nightmare at 20,000 feet. So that one for me. But Nightcaller, how about that one?
Nightcall is in my top three, yeah. And there's a sweetness to it, but man, for a while there, you're as scared as that old lady is.
Yes, and it's just, if you're asleep, and sometimes I'll wake up and I'll have imagined a loud sound, like a phone or someone banging at the door, and I don't think it's actually happened, and your heart is at like 200 beats per minute. So she's has this boring life, and she's waiting for something to happen. It's the end of life, and not a lot occurs during her days, and she was one of those people who, I kind of had an aunt like this, who had this like sort of one romantic interlude in her life that didn't come to full fruition. She was engaged. And you learn this backstory. It's a horrible, tragic, just gutting backstory as the teleplay goes along, but she gets this phone call and goes out to the cemetery and with the maid, and there's this telephone wire, and it's touching this grave. And that was riffing off something that actually happened back at the time, because people would be buried alive, like quite unintentionally. They'd be interred in the crypt. So at the time, earlier in the 20th century, crypts actually had devices inside of them to say, like, hey, not yet, come get me, I've revived. And I would imagine that was particularly terrifying to people at the time. But Night Call is just, I don't know if it's more scary or sad, but it's certainly very much the former.
Now, one that scares me, and I think it's because it must be one of the first Twilight Zones that I saw, and I don't think it was in its original run, but maybe because I was pretty young when it went off the air in 64, but something about it scared me and still does. The one about Custer, the seventh, is made up of phantoms.
Yes, that's another one. And again, that whole notion of the Western. And I think we could also mention the 30 Fathom Grave from that neglected.
Oh, yes, yes.
Where it maybe suffers a bit. It's padded because they had to go to the hour length, and that wasn't a format that this particular show excelled at. But sometimes the scariest things that draw you, or at least the scariest works that draw you in the most, are works where you need to know what is up, what is going on, what is the explanation for. For instance, you ever see like a photo, and it's from an operation, it's something really gruesome, and you don't know what it is yet. Like, you just know that it's something that's probably going to be upsetting to you. Then you read the caption, and it's like gallbladder being removed from, right? And then, like, something clicks in your mind. It becomes, it's still the same visual, but it becomes something different. And I feel like it's that trepidation we have for when we read the caption and we know, oh, that's what's going on. I don't like that at all. I hoped it was something else. And I feel like the 30 Fathom Grave is an episode that does that well.
And then finally, there are two involving kids that I find especially frightening, maybe as a parent, but even before I had a kid, I think so. And that's the Bill Mumy episode, Long Distance Call, where his grandmother is essentially trying to get him to join her in the great beyond. And then the little one with the girl that gets disappears under the bed, girl lost.
Yeah. And that was inspired by writer's kid falling out of bed, and she went under the bed and was like, oh, where's the voice? And that's clearly a big influence, too, on the whole television thing in The Exorcist, that notion of, like, daddy, I'm in the television sort of deal. And it's a simple plot, that idea of the person dislocated from their existence. And it's just such a humble terror. It's such a small-scale terror that I think it becomes bigger because it's easy to identify with, like, what could prevent this from happening? It seems pretty feasible. And the grandmother who's trying to get into the murder game, that is, makes you wonder. Like, you think about it ideologically. Is it like you go to this other plane and now you have these designs that you didn't have in life? Because it's not like his parents are like, oh, good thing she's gone. She's always trying to murder the boy. Like, she gets into that more in the afterlife. And then it's also sad for the grandmother, because you think of the loneliness of a state or plane or whatever that she might be occupying, that you're so desperate to curtail that loneliness that you will snuff out a young life of someone you ostensibly love.
From the Twilight Zone, let's go to 1964 and a Halloween show at Philharmonic Hall in New York City with Bob Dylan, old friend Joan Baez, and sort of a combination of the protest songs that had made him famous and some of the early indications of him branching out to a different direction.
Yeah, I was listening to the recording and not the bootleg, and it was bothering me because some of the exchanges between songs do not seem to be on the Amazon Music version. Like, for instance, at the beginning of I Don't Believe You, he forgets the first line and he has to ask for help. And I'm not hearing that today as I listen on Amazon, which is irking me, but it's certainly a mashup. Dylan's only 23 years old, which is, I think, staggering to some people. I've known people who are 23 who just use that as an excuse. Like, they they couldn't know that much yet, or they couldn't be that smart, or they are doing all of these stupid, mindless things because of their relative youth. And I always think, I don't know, that's on you. You're not 13. 23 is a lot different to me, and you can point to Dylan for this set. It's just, like you said, it's Joan Baez on a few numbers, but for the most part, it's him on the stage. And it was on a bootleg for a long time, was still out there, called All Hallows Eve. It's just him, his guitar, and the harmonica. And he's playing these protest songs, certainly, but he's also playing songs from the acoustic half of Bringing It All Back Home and Garden of Eden, It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding. These are Mr. Tambourine Man. These are like 8, 9, 10 minute, highly lyrically complex songs. And it's interesting to hear how he deploys the harmonica. He uses it as this, well, anyone who's ever read Shakespeare knows that we talk about a foil. And Dylan uses the harmonica at this show very much in the foil mode. And you're never like, oh, I'm lacking for sound. It's just a guy with a guitar and a harmonica. It's a full sound. Whenever I walk past somebody like busking in the Common, and it's just like some ordinary person. It's never special. It never stands out. And I always think, like, how do you listen to something like Dylan and think, I should be out here doing this, that maybe you should be off somewhere else working on getting better at? Because I think I would have walked past Dylan and been like, oh my God, this is just like, what are you up to, dude? And I think it's the best, it's not like there's a lot of competition, it's the best Halloween concert ever given, but it doesn't make those lists because those lists are short-sighted, but it should be on those lists of the best live albums, period, that have ever been cut in popular music.
Let's talk Ghosts and Haunted House there, Mr. Fleming. Where are you on that spectrum? Do you believe?
When I was a kid, and this is what made me think of suggesting this to you. When I was a kid, I used to be scared of the dark, and I would sleep in a Spider-Man sleeping bag in the room next to the room where my parents were watching TV, which was good for me because I heard a lot of Fred Cusick calling Bruins games, and that was influential. But I was terrified of the dark, and my dad was like, he was firm. He was unequivocal on this point. He said, there's no such thing as ghosts. And I believe this for the most part. But then I thought, you believe what your dad says to you when you're a certain age. You cannot be wrong. But there's so much that we don't know, for instance. And I think probably like something like death, I don't think it's like what we think death is. I don't think you're like, if you just cease being in this world and you're somewhere else. I think it's probably so much more complex than any thought any human has ever had or could have, perhaps. And maybe we're all dead now and you're not officially told. Like, who knows how it works? Maybe you and I are off somewhere else in a different dimension having a different conversation about the best Halloween candies. Who knows, right? And so I've thought more about that as I've gotten older. And I think we've all walked into a place, and you probably have experienced this as a teacher, maybe it's a home or something like that, where we just know it's not a great space. Like, you go into it and you just think something is off here. And it's not because you're watching somebody like take a meat cleaver to somebody else at the other side of the room. It's a feeling you get. And I think there's a kind of energy that manifests itself that way.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I don't, I don't know for sure. I've certainly, I approach it as a skeptic, and yet I've had some experiences along the way that I can't explain. And I always think of it, I guess, as energy. And I don't know that I picture people floating around like Casper, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But the idea that energy can linger, particularly in a place, it's hard not to buy into at least some of that, I think.
I was in Manchester by the Sea a bunch of years ago, and there's this cemetery, although I guess it would have been called the graveyard. There's like that demarcation point in time when they go from burial grounds or graveyards to cemeteries. Or cemeteries is a much more antiseptic term. You wouldn't have a cemetery like in a Universal horror film. It's always a graveyard or burial ground. And I took this photo, and there was this old cemetery. So the headstones are from like the 1700s. And I didn't really look at it that closely. I shared it with some people later. I put it up on Facebook back when I was on there. And people thought I had doctored this photo to make it look like there were these sort of ghost figures all coming through the boughs and the trees and everything. And if you know me, you know that that's so far beyond my skill set. It was like a minor miracle that I was able to like Dropbox that bad boy and upload it to Facebook or whatever I did after reading a tutorial and watching a help video on YouTube. So I don't know. It would seem that would be a good place for this energy of which we speak. But I think sometimes we can feel things so intensely that we do leave a kind of imprint. I know, you know, about some of the experiences I've had in the house, and I'm not dead yet or certainly anything like that, but I'm starting in that place in Rockport where I lived through those times and wrote a number of the things that I wrote. I'm sure that I've left something of myself there. Of that I have no doubt, regardless of whether my dad was right or wrong.
Very interesting stuff, as always. Our friend Colin Fleming with us. Visit his website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Colin, we thank you as always, and we'll visit again next week.
Sounds good, bye.